the group of psychic consciousness, the physical body a group of atomic consciousness. The group soul is one and yet many. The informing spirit makes these souls one. I think I have explained to you before, that as there are certain centers in the brain, so in psychic life there are a number of souls all bound together by one spirit, depending for their nourishment on that spirit. When I was on earth I belonged to a group soul, but its branches and the spirit which might be compared to the roots were in the invisible. Now, if you would understand psychic evolution, this group soul must be studied and understood. For instance, it explains many of the difficulties that people will assure you can be removed only by the doctrine of reincarnation. You may think my statement frivolous, but the fact that we do appear on earth to be paying for the sins of another life is, in a certain sense, true. It was our life, and yet not our life. In other words, a soul belonging to the group of which I am a part lived that previous life which built up for me the framework of my earthly life, lived it before I had passed through the gates of birth. In this invisible world there is infinite variety of conditions. I can only speak of what I know. I do not claim to be infallible. Take the following as the axiom I would lay down for you. Many soul men do not seek another earth life, but their spirit manifests itself many times on earth and it is the bond which holds together a group of souls, who, in the ascending scale of psychic evolution, act and react upon one another. So, when I talk of my spiritual forebears I do not speak of my physical ancestors, I speak of those soul ancestors who are bound to me by one spirit. There may be contained within that spirit 20 souls, 100 souls, 1,000 souls. The number varies. It is different for each man. But what the Buddhists would call the karma I had brought with me from a previous life is, very frequently, not that of my life, but of the life of a soul that preceded me by many years on earth and left for me the pattern which made my life. I, too, wove a pattern for another of my group during my earthly career. We are all of us distinct, though we are influenced by others of our community on the various planes of being. When your Buddhist speaks of the cycle of births, of man's continual return to earth, he utters but a half-truth. And often half a truth is more inaccurate than an entire misstatement. I shall not live again on earth, but a new soul, one who will join our group, will shortly enter into the pattern or karma I have woven for him on earth. No doubt karma is a word I use incorrectly here. For it is something more and something less than karma that he inherits. I am, therefore, a kingdom, and yet I am but a unit in that kingdom. You may say to me that, for the soul man, one earth life is not enough. But, as we evolve here, we enter into those memories and experiences of other lives that are to be found in the existence of the souls that preceded us, and are of our group. I do not say that this theory, which I offer you, can be laid down as a general rule. But undoubtedly it is true in so far as it is what I have learned and experienced. Now, this speculation as you would probably call it is interesting when applied to genius. The souls who have preceded us on earth naturally stamp us mentally and morally. If a certain type of psyche is continually being evolved in the one group, you will find that eventually that type, if it be musical, will have a musical genius as its representative on earth. It will harvest all the tendencies in those vanished lives, and it will then have the amazing unconscious knowledge that is the property of genius. Here, in the after-death, we become more and more aware of this group soul as we make progress. Eventually we enter into it and share the experiences of our brethren. You must understand, therefore, that existence for my soul as separate and apart from my individual ego is dual. I live two lives, one in the world of form, and one subjective, in the community of which I am a member. Men and women may not care to accept these statements of mine. They long either for an indestructible individuality in the hereafter or for a kind of spiritual swoon in the life of God. You will perceive in my analysis of the group soul that we are individuals and members of one whole. And when you come to the fourth, and more particularly to the fifth stage, you will realize how fine and beautiful is this brotherhood within the one being, how it deepens and intensifies existence, how it destroys the cold selfishness so necessary to an earth life, where one living creature must continually destroy another's manifestation in matter in order to maintain its physical life. In the fourth stage, the soul becomes sensible of the group soul, and through the awareness there arises a great change. He begins gropingly to realize the character of experience, the possibilities of mind, and in this fourth stage, if he is a soul man, he is peculiarly liable to error. That is to say, once he becomes cognizant of the group soul and of its many emotional and intellectual experiences, he may, if a certain section of that group soul be in a fixed mold, take upon himself its shape and remain within it for eons of time. In this connection, when I write mold, I desire to indicate a certain special outlook. For instance, a fanatical Buddhist or a very devout Christian may be held within the groove of his earthly beliefs. For those other souls in his community are, perhaps, also, held in the chains of those particular ideas. So there he may remain, making no progress, in a thought or in a memory world which consists of the Christian or of the Buddhist dream. He is held fast in the tentacles of an octopus. This octopus is the earthly Christian or Buddhist idea of an afterlife, their view of the universe as created when on earth. Now, you will recognize that such conditions tend to inhibit progress. For it means, to use another metaphor, dwelling in an intellectual chrysalis, living in the past earthly conceptions. And it is needful that the journeying soul should come to a state in which he can at will survey them, but not be held by them, or be imprisoned in their limitations. Spirit man is not caught in this Eidolon or living ghost, in this wraith of earthly beliefs. The great masters are not thus ensnared. Christ, the Son of God, entered into Hades, but he did not abide in any of the other planes of being. Christ, being inspired directly by God, was connected with no group soul. He passed from Hades out yonder, for his physical body was, during his lifetime on earth, the direct expression in the clay of that essence, the imagination of God. Truly, Christ was a limited expression of the whole, was in earthly life linked to the whole. But every Christian born upon the earth is inspired by some individualized spirit. When I write individualized, I desire to indicate that it is a thought of God. It is not, therefore, the whole, it is not the fount of all life. So there are numerous fanatical Christians who, though they led lives of rectitude on earth, committed certain intellectual sins. These might be summed up in the phrase rigidity of thought, an outlook limited by fanaticism. Briefly, they are wedded to a limited concept. In the fourth stage of existence, they must learn how to escape from such a prison if they are to make further progress. These remarks apply equally to Buddhists, Mohammedans, and all those other fanatical adherents of various religions or, as in the modern world, of scientific conceptions. For science tends more and more to become a religion or special outlook for many human beings. Now, if the soul is to pass from the fourth to the fifth stage, he must first shake off, cast from him any dogma, any special earthly outlook which has shaped his mentality, which confines it, so that his vision is limited, and his experiences are, therefore, also limited, consciousness of reality being thus withheld from him. 46. Chapter 7. The Plane of Flame. The fifth plane, birth into the fifth stage. There comes a time when the soul who dwells on the fourth plane of life prepares for the incident of death. This death does not resemble the death of man. At this particular point in evolution, the soul has perfect and absolute control of form, of his appearance, of his Eidolon or living ghost. This is the last veil between him and a conception of existence without form. He must free himself before he can go up another rung of the ladder, and freedom can only come through the deliberate process called the breaking of the image. It is the farewell to appearance, to form as a necessity, to color, to feeling as a certainty, as a condition of life. Again the soul enters into unconsciousness, and when he is born into the fifth stage, he has cast from him certain attributes that were his when he still inhabited the image, for his soul was, in part, that shape of light he was now discarded. Between each plane there is this lapse into apparent oblivion, a stilling of all processes, a great calm. It is called Hades by the ancients. Here the soul seems to pause. Slowly, however, vision returns, the traveler perceives, imaged upon the glimmering sea of eternity, all his experiences on previous planes, all the past images that make up the story of his life are spread before him. He studies them in the light of his unifying principle or spirit. They rouse, according to his nature, his varying desires, intellectual and emotional. He knows then that he must choose either to go forward or backwards. The spirit actually forces the choice. It has to be made according to the fullness of his experiences in the previous life. He has entire free will, but inevitably he chooses his greatest need. When at the gate of illusion land, the animal man chooses to drop back into a physical existence. When at the gate of the many-colored world, the soul man sometimes chooses to drop back into the first division of this region, which, in its last divisions, is the apotheosis of form. However, supposing that his review of his previous lives is satisfactory, B will decide to go on to the fifth stage, and then the great calm is broken. There arises a tempest wherein he discards his desire for existence in etherealized form, in that plane of color. He discards then a certain part of himself which he will not lose but resume in the greater wholeness of the sixth stage. The symbol of the fifth stage it is necessary to describe by some symbol each chapter in the Book of Life. The term flame expresses the fifth stage. For now the soul becomes emotionally whole, aware not alone of himself, but of all those other souls who are of his group. He remains himself, yet is all those other selves as well. He no longer dwells in form as it is conceived by man, but he dwells still in what might be described as an outline. All the past emotions, passions, intellectual modes of expression belonging to his companion souls shape this outline, an outline of emotional thought, a great fire which stirs and moves this mighty being now. While he abides in this fifth plane, experience is manifold, is a multiplication, loses, in a sense, its apparent oneness. He lives indeed a life that seems to burn like a flame. It is a time of severe discipline, of vastly increased intellectual feeling, of great limitations, of boundless. The plane of flame freedoms, of the glimpsing of infinite horizons, swoons of contemplation, agonies of dreaming, states in which all lucid thought lies fallow, states in which the intense feverish activities of all the passionate existence of his comrade souls flame through his being. He is thus all the time becoming more and more merged with the unifying spirit. A rare intensity of feeling, of joy, of ecstasy, of sorrow, of dark despair nourish him, feed his life. Yet, all the while, he is, in a sense, apart, aloof. He is not caught in the storm of this emotional whirlpool. He is sensible of it, yet rides above it. His attitude, however, does not resemble that of St. Simeon Stylites, who remained upon his pillar remote and aloof from the gorgeous ancient world which was playing out its drama in those Mediterranean lands of his day. The soul, on this fifth level of consciousness, is continuously conscious. There are now no gaps, no periods of non-existence. He revels in the emotional and intellectual life of all those comrade souls who are on the various rungs of the ladders which reach up to the one spirit and are lighted by it. But this soul, at the climax of his existence on the plane of flame, is as an artist who lives in his masterpiece, derives from it, in all its features, in the freshness of its evolving, changing creation, that strange exaltation which may, perhaps, at one rare moment, they're known to a creative genius though very faintly while he still lives upon the earth. This state on the fifth plane may be imagined but not understood or conceived by a man's mind. To the traveling soul the purpose of his existence will seem to be, at last, revealed. He tastes of heaven and yet the revelation of the last mystery still tarries, still awaits the completion of the design of which he is a part. It is a glorious existence, despite certain sinister aspects. The soul man, however, may not leave it for the sixth plane until the group soul is complete, until those other souls, necessary to this design woven in the tapestry of eternity, have also attained to this level of consciousness. Some may still be far behind. But while in this state of being, the soul man becomes aware of the emotional life of all the more primitive souls who inhabit denser and denser matter and, yet, belong to his group. He becomes aware, In short, of all the parts of the great body which his spirit, or the unifying principle, feeds with its light, he realizes the subconscious life of the flower, the insect, the bird, the beast, all those forms which are connected with the governor of his being, that light from above. The construction of the group soul, the actual construction of the group soul must be clearly visualized. Its spirit feeds, with life and mental light, certain plants, trees, flowers, birds, insects, fish, beasts, men and women, representatives of living creatures in varying states of evolution. It inspires souls who are on various planes, various levels of consciousness in the after-death. It feeds, also, creatures on other planets. For the spirit must gather a harvest of experience in every form. Gradually these intelligences evolve and merge. The experience necessary to the spirit is completed when all the souls necessary to the design have reached this fifth plane. Once they become sensible of their oneness and their individuality, they may go forward to the sixth plane. There is, then, a breaking of the threads, a casting away of the dross of emotional experience, a sifting and changing on the part of all these souls. They pass once more into Hades and review, in that state, all that now lies behind them. 50. Chapter 8. The plane of white light. The sixth plane, pure reason light, though composed of many colors, is colorless. The spirit, though composed of many souls, is above and beyond pleasurable and painful moods of the mind. It belongs, therefore, to the sixth plane, which is suitably described by the symbol of white light. Now, on this level of consciousness, pure reason reigns supreme. Emotion and passion, as known to men, are absent. White light represents the perfect equanimity of pure thought. Such equanimity becomes the possession of the souls who enter this last rich kingdom of experience. They bear with them the wisdom of form, the incalculable secret wisdom, gathered only through limitation, harvested from numberless years, garnered from lives passed in myriad forms. Knowledge of good and evil and of what lies beyond good and evil now belongs to them. They are lords of life, for they have conquered. They are capable of living now without form, of existing as white light, as the pure thought of their Creator. They have joined the immortals. The purpose of the sixth plane of being might be described as the assimilation of the many in one, the unifying of all those mind units I have called souls, within the spirit. When this aim has been achieved, the spirit which contains this strange individualized life passes out yonder and enters into the mystery, thereby fulfilling the final purpose, the evolution of the supreme mind. Chapter 9, Out Yonder, Timelessness, the seventh plane. Part of the divine principle. Again the choice must be made. Is the soul prepared to make the great leap, prepared to pass wholly from time into timelessness, from an existence in form into formlessness? This is the most difficult of all questions to answer. Only a very few reply in the affirmative when first faced with it. The seventh state might be described as the passage from form into formlessness. But pray do not misunderstand the term formlessness. I merely wish to indicate by it an existence that has no need to express itself in a shape, however tenuous, however fine. The soul who enters the seventh state passes into the beyond and becomes one with God. This merging with the idea, with the great source of spirit, does not imply annihilation. You still exist as an individual. You are as a wave in the sea, and you have at last entered into reality and cast from you all the illusions of appearances. But some intangible essence has been added to your spirit through its long habitation of matter, of ether, the ancestor of matter, of what the scientists call empty space, though, if they but knew it, empty space is peopled with forms of an infinite fineness and variety. Actually, the passage from the sixth to the seventh state means the flight from the material universe, from that space which is a part of it. You dwell not only outside of time but outside of the universe on this last plane of out yonder, timelessness being. Yet you can be and are, in one sense, within the universe. You as part of the whole, and by the whole I indicate God, may be likened to the sun. Your rays pervade the material universe, yet your spirit remains detached from it, reigning in the great calm of eternity. To be of the universe and to be apart from it is, possibly, the final achievement, the goal of all endeavor. In a few brief words, I have spanned existence within eons of time, and I have endeavored to give you a glimpse of that mystery, timelessness. When you dwell out yonder, you, as a part of the divine principle in its essence, are wholly aware of the imagination of God. So you are aware of every second in time, you are aware of the whole history of the earth from Alpha to Omega. Equally, all planetary existence is yours. Everything created is contained within that imagination, and you, now by reason of your immortality, know it and hold, as the earth holds a seed, the whole of life, the past, the future, all that is, all that shall be forever and forever. The beyond baffles description. It is heartbreaking even to attempt to write of it. That spirit man, God the Son, expressed a great truth when he said, "Many are called and few are chosen. Only a very few pass out yonder during the life of the earth. A certain number of souls attain to the sixth state, but remain in it or, in exceptional cases for a lofty purpose, descend again into matter. They are not strong enough to make the great leap into timelessness, they are not yet perfect." Chapter 10, The Universe. The Buddhist maintains that the universe is unreal. It is unreal only so long as you are caught in its web, governed by its laws, controlled by its matter or by that invisible substance I have called an air of matter. The term unreal implies falsehood, sham, humbug. The soul, when he manifests himself in form, is limited by that form. He cannot know truth because he is imprisoned in that shape. He has, during his life on those first five planes, a limited view. Like a horse, wearing blinkers, he has a very poor idea of the world about him. The essential unreality arises through this specialized view merely of a piece of the road before him. Further, the form lies in the picture of this road which it conveys to the soul. So the Buddhist is in one sense right when he claims that the universe is unreal. But when the sage claims that the ultimate goal is one of extinction within nirvana, extinction though not annihilation, he is using dangerous terms. He claims that we are extinguished once we reach this state of grace, this world of the absolute. He suggests, however, that at any rate we are existing in unconditioned being, we are entirely apart from the universe, freed from its essential unreality. Actually, only on the seventh plane when we are one with the supreme idea do we realize the reality of the universe. It is unreal so long as it imprisons soul and spirit. It is real once these are merged and freed from it, dwelling in the infinite liberty of pure intelligence. Once that state is attained, we perceive that old master, peace, the universe, as a whole. We realize it in every microscopic detail, and in its greatest proportions. We perceive the whole of it as an intellectual concept within the supreme idea. We perceive the part of it that is playing out its drama. And thus we exist as the seer and the lover, experiencing all that life as an act of thought. So we reach the zenith of experience. We know the reality of the material universe, we are aware of the other reality. The idea, which contains its duplicate from the beginning to the end as a thought. We cannot be said to be extinct. We are one in the great harmony of mind, we are individual in the love of the Creator for His creation which is contained within Him, which is manifested in part. We receive from all those myriad spirits who control parts of the material universe the complete impression of it in its least, in its greatest aspects. Therefore we live as never before. We are caught in no nirvanic swoon. And we join in that contemplation of the destruction of the present universe, of the creation, life and extinction of other universes, and so on endlessly. We live in the intellectual concept of them all, and we are aware of that part which now plays out its drama on the stage of eternity. Try to realize the dual character of existence when you think of the word universe, then it may be easier to understand the nature of life. There are physical atoms and there are psychic units. The psychic unit develops as it dwells within and without the physical atoms, in the various stages of existence. The psychic unit dwells within the fantasy of ever finer and finer substance, gaining all the while. The psychic unit escapes from that substance, returns to its home in the idea. But this escape does not mean annihilation. It is one now and yet many, just as the physical atoms of the human body are one and yet many. Understand, therefore, that the universe is only unreal so long as you dwell within its confining web, within form. It is real when you are free from it and are able from out yonder to survey it as a whole and to know it as an act of pure thought. Chapter 11, From the World of Eidos. The discarnate being who has conveyed this message has remained in touch with the earth and has followed, step by step, since his death at the beginning of the century, the progress of science, the great war, which has been continued in the economic war. He has, through communion with the inner mind of his friends who still exist in physical bodies, perceived the change in man's spiritual outlook, perceived his urgent need for some cogent assurance of a spiritual world. Because a man dies, it does not follow that he loses touch with the earth, with that state of penial poverty from which he rose into the delights of the plane named illusion, from which he penetrated into the world of Eidos pure form to the human soul the heaven world, the ultimate goal. For while on earth the human soul has, in rare moments, perceived that world but has not passed beyond it even when in the loftiest mystic trance, we intelligences who have journeyed as far as Eidos may, when we choose, journey back to the state of penia and commune with those who love us or who are to us mentally akin. We perceive, then, the strange disorder of the world of men and women. We recognize the causes of that disorder and the purpose behind them. We realize the necessity for such disorder and at the same time we desire to convey some indication of the great reality. For this reason I, Frederick Myers, have endeavored to trace a rough outline of the road man must follow in the afterlife if he be a seeker of immortality. The Plane of Color. Chapter 12, The Incident of Death. To those of us who have reached that unseen bourne from which travelers in a changed aspect frequently return, death is an incident or a mere episode which we regard with a certain tenderness and not with any pain. To human beings, however, death should seem as a night at an inn, as a halt on the long road home. It may be a night of feverish insomnia, or heavy with fear, a night full of strange dreams, or a period of almost undisturbed peace. Always there is, contained in it, a time of stillness, of sinking gloriously into rest. Nevertheless, the soul eventually wakens, to a new day. And, in dawn and dark alike, he is surrounded by certain of his discarnate kindred, by some of those who are woven into the pattern of his destiny. Before we discuss death further, we must be agreed on the meaning of one word which has caused much confusion of thought. The term discarnate being does not imply separation from any body whatsoever, but from exclusive association with the physical body. For, until the wayfarer reaches the sixth plane, he must customarily use some form, some vehicle of expression, some outward sign or symbol of himself. Many are these forms. For our present purpose it is advisable that I should name only four of them. 1. The double or unifying body, in my opinion falsely named the astral body. 2. The etheric body. 3. The subtle body. 4. The celestial body or shape of light. The two latter are occupied by the soul on the higher planes and can be altered greatly in appearance by a mental act, or by an act of will. Now, discarnate intelligences have probably informed you that the secret of death is to be found in the rate of speed at which the outer shell vibrates. For instance, a human being is primarily aware of the visible world about him because his body is traveling at its particular rate of speed. Alter the timing of your physical form, and the earth, men, women and all material objects, will vanish for you as you vanish for them. Death, therefore, means merely a change of speed. For the purpose of this change a temporary dislocation is necessary, for the soul must pass from one body traveling at a certain vibration to another traveling at a different rate or time. This entry into the next life involves no sudden break, no leap, as it were, into new conditions. There must, necessarily, be an intermediate state. Even Christ entered into it, abiding, as you have been told, for a period in Hades. And so we come to the first question. In what form does the human being express himself during the hours that immediately follow the moment when the physician declares that life is extinct? Where is the beloved? We ask in our wordless misery as we watch by that shell, which, a few minutes previously, contained that bright, living personality, for us so radiant and so dear, quick in perception, eager in intelligence. During the hour after the passing of a soul with whom we have been intimately bound, it is hard to believe in extinction.